Thanks for listening to Coach Your Brains Out. This is part two of our conversation with Peter Habrill on mindfulness. In this episode, Peter leads us through some sample practices, so hopefully you can jump in and try it along with us, and it'll give you some ideas for running your own mindfulness sessions with your team, or just on your own. So here we go. Anticipation is like this. Welcome to Coach Your Brains Out, the show that explores learning from the top minds in volleyball and beyond. With your hosts, John Mayer, Billy Allen, Andrew Fuller, and Nils Nielsen.
So I've committed to doing this, 10 to 15 minute a day, and I'm definitely enjoying it and seeing some benefits. And I've been kind of toying around this idea of like a longer retreat, but then you think about leaving family and probably just the challenges of doing it. I don't know, I guess sell me on it more. Like, why would I want to spend multiple days or maybe even a week away from family and away just from everything? What would be, I don't know, why would that be a big jump from just doing this 10 to 15 minute practice a day?
Yeah, so how old is your kid, John?
She's seven.
She's seven, right? Do you still read to her at night?
Yeah.
Yeah, so if your mind's like my mind, right, when my kids were that age, and I would read to them, and sometimes I would notice I would read the page and I had no idea what I read.
I've had that happen.
So I totally wasn't present, right? So what these retreats do for me, they sort of reset and strengthen my ability to actually be present, and in this case, be present for, the loved ones in my life. And I would make an argument that's actually beneficial. So while it may seem selfish to go on retreat, it's actually to the benefit of others, because then you're more present when you are with others.
And then
that makes sense.
Yeah. And I know we kind of talked about it, but I'm going to ask it again, because I feel like when I first started thinking about doing meditation or mindfulness practices, that I would become like bulletproof to negative thoughts. And like you said, that's not the goal. And you kind of mentioned, instead of coming in with like this armor, you kind of come in a little more open, and it's almost like improv. Can you talk a little bit more about that, by like showing up and just being kind of aware and open to whatever may come, versus like, oh, I'm coming in super determined, this is how this match is going to go?
Yeah, it's actually a great metaphor, this idea of being bulletproof, right? Because one interpretation of being bulletproof is there will be no more negative thoughts. But the other way to look at that is being bulletproof is that the negative thoughts don't harm you anymore. They're still there, right? They still pop into your head. But because you can see them as just thoughts, rather than the truth or a command you have to obey, right, then they no longer have a negative impact over you. So what we're after with mindfulness is to get really good at understanding what's the function of this thought in this context. And if the function is helpful, right, then I can use the information the thought provides. If the function is not helpful, then I can just, hey, this is just a thought bubble that popped into my head. It's going to come and go. I can move on. I don't have to entertain it.
Yeah, and I think, like you said, when all lights are green and maybe you're in this flow state, it's nice and it makes it easier, but that's probably pretty rare. And one of the, I guess, phrases that we learned from you and kind of incorporated into our games a lot this year and last year was like, this is the toughest match of the year. And so instead of looking at it like, oh, we've practiced really hard, this should be easy, no matter what, just kind of expecting that there's going to be challenges and even addressing what those might be. Can you talk about, I guess, where you got that phrase? I think it was like an Nadal thing, and kind of maybe some story behind that of approaching the next opponent as if it's the toughest match of the year.
Yeah, I'm always impressed with Nadal when I read his interviews in Grand Slam finals, Grand Slam tournaments, and you read him, in the first round, And then he's being asked about his opponent in the next round, in the second round, and his answer is very consistent, is that's going to be the toughest match ever. And it's the third round, it's going to be the toughest match ever. And it's the fourth round, toughest match ever, and quarterfinal, toughest match ever, semifinal, toughest match ever, and final, toughest match ever. And what that tells me is, by approaching it that way, he never falls into the trap of thinking things will be easy, and then when they're hard, not being able to adjust to that. So once he expects things to be difficult, right, he'll come fully prepared. And that way, he's never surprised by an opponent. And to me, that's a very skillful way to work with expectations that come up all the time, right? And the way the mind works is you want to think, hey, next round is going to be easy, right? Because that's comfortable. That feels good. And we all want to feel good. But almost always, that's a trap. So we're better off not falling prey to those automatic expectations, but in his case, in Nadal's case, to deliberately choose, hey, this is going to be difficult, so let me bring my A game, let me prepare the right way, right? And maybe be open to whatever may happen and then adjust accordingly.
Right. I'm thinking of coaches who might be listening and thinking, oh, you know, I can really picture the right athlete who struggles with the mental side of the game, and I'm going to have them do some mindfulness. But maybe this athlete, you know, who's really, they see as mentally tough, you know, I don't want to change that, and I don't want to offer this. Do you think there are athletes who maybe, you know, oh, you know, don't mess with overthinking this stuff and just keep going? Or do you think mindfulness can benefit anybody?
Well, I think mindfulness certainly benefits the more cerebral athlete, right? That said, I think mindfulness benefits everyone. I'm not a big fan of the term mental toughness, to be quite honest, because tough to me is rigid and inflexible. And and usually we associate being tough with not having any uncomfortable thoughts and feelings, not having any doubt, right? And that's great as long as things go well, but sooner or later in sport, you run into difficulties. And then toughness actually doesn't serve you because it limits your repertoire of behavior, right? Whereas as when you're flexible, then you can adjust to whatever the moment serves up.
That's interesting because I guess I would always thought that when I'm picturing some of my players on my teams, the ones that are mentally tough, you might be able to pick out, but that was probably just because they were really good. And so they didn't have the same challenges that maybe a weaker player would have because they weren't tested as much.
Yes, that's often correct, right? And again, those players, then once they encounter difficulties, struggles, once they get to the next level, they often lack the toolkit to handle those situations.
All right. And then one more on mindfulness before we move on. But I was curious what social noting is and what's the benefits for doing a solo practice?
Social noting is sort of an evolution of mindfulness practice that was developed by a guy named Kenneth Folk and then his buddy Vince Horn. And they sort of took this idea of what's in silent practice called sort of silent noting practice, where you just in your internal sort of silent voice would rehearse, would know what's present, right? They started doing that aloud and doing it with others. And that social noting practice then actually sort of in a way turbocharges the practice because you have this natural feedback loop where you hear somebody else reporting on their mind state, and that tends to keep you more in the present moment. So it augments the quality of practice, plus to do it in a small group, it's just more fun than to do it by yourself.
Yeah, and this is during quarantine when we weren't able to practice, this is something that I was trying to do a lot with you guys, with you, Peter, and we had a group of other athletes, and I found it way more engaging than like lying on my floor listening to like a Headspace or something. And yeah, there was a sense of camaraderie, and it definitely kept you present when you're having to actually play off of other people. So yeah, I would definitely recommend doing it. And it's perfect because if you're a coach, like you have a team there and you have athletes that maybe you can kind of facilitate, or whether you group them into small groups or do it as a big group. We'd like to describe some of the practices. And I know there's a whole bunch, even in the months that we did, you know, it was a new practice every week. But are there any simple group practices that maybe coaches can do with their athletes that we can describe and talk about here?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, here's sort of a very simple one, an awareness practice, right? So I call this the weather check of the mind, where you use the phrase "there is," and then you use one or two words to describe what the weather of your mind is right now. So the metaphoric weather of your mind, right? So this could be, there is anxiety, or there is joy, there is frustration, or there is cloudiness, right? So at the beginning of practice, however big the group is, you just go around the group and have everybody do a quick weather check and sort of share where they're at, right? So then I raise awareness. This is what's present right now, right? This is what I get to work with, and I'm going to be more able to skillfully work with it once I'm aware of it. It'll be a very simple practice. There is, and the weather check of the mind, as a very sort of, you know, simple form of social noting practice. Then we could also do a concentration practice. So in silent meditation, one tool that folks use often is a silent cue, right, to help you with your attention. And this would be like, for example, when you do breath counting practice, okay? So the way this works silently is at when I inhale and exhale, I would note in and out. If we do this as a social practice, the three of us, for example, right? So I would begin with, at the top of my in-breath, I note in. At the bottom of the out-breath, Billy will go out. At the top of John's in-breath, he would go in. And if you want to, we can demonstrate that real quick.
Yeah.
All right. Here we go. In.
Out.
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 In.
All right, very, very good, very good. I think this is enough to give folks a taste, right? So maybe just have, what was this like for you two?
Sometimes I feel like trying to fall into a rhythm, and listening to you guys more than I was aware of my own breathing sometimes.
Yeah, I felt like I was judgmental. I was like, man, my out is too long. But it made me really aware of when I was breathing.
So just notice, right, with that comment, John, and Billy as well, so commentary came up, right? The thought and emotion producing factory kicked in, okay? Now, that said, did we lose the in-out rhythm?
No.
No. did you lose your own rhythm, so to speak, from in out?
No.
No. Okay. So we trained collectively our ability to aim attention on the chosen anchor attention, the in out, right? We also trained our ability to notice thoughts coming up and feelings coming up. And we train our ability to come back to the anchor of attention, which is precisely, again, the skills we want to have when we're, you know, when in you guys' case, on the beach or on the court as well, right? Can I notice here's the internal dialogue? Yep. And now I come back to put my attention where I want it to be.
Mm-hmm. And I think what's interesting in a lot of these practices is there's times that there are mistakes. So like maybe somebody would say in when they should have said out. But like you say, that's just part of the practice.
Exactly. It's part of the practice, right? Because again, mistakes will happen. There's nothing wrong with that, because the moment mistakes will happen, that judgmental voice kicks in. Can I be aware of it? And then can I come back and again focus on the next in-breath or the next out-breath? So maybe in connection with this, what would also be good to show is maybe more advanced or more difficult practice. So noting mind states. And what we do in noting mind states, we're trying to note all the physical and emotional patterns that we normally capture as an emotion or as an attitude of mind or as a meditative state. So these might be things like anger, joy, love, pride, stillness, calmness, and so forth. We're trying to capture these emotional moments by noting them aloud. Again, we'll do this in sequential order. If you find yourself to be stuck, if you don't know what to say, then you can use what's called the pressure release valve, which is you would say uncertainty, right? Noting uncertainty. And obviously that's a mind state as well. So this is a more complex practice, right? But just to give the listeners a taste of this. And the way I like to do this is like this practice, right? So we note the emotional state and we add the phrase is like this. I think you both remember that, right?
Yeah.
Because what that does is it heightens the awareness of that emotional state, and at the same time creates a bit of separation from that state.
Cool.
Nice. So if you're driving, maybe push pause and save this for a later time.
Absolutely. And if you can't do that, keep your eyes on the road and focus on the road.
Do you have your chimes, Peter?
I do, yes. I'll be glad to ring them, yes.
All right, let's
get the full treatment.
Here you go. Excitement is like this.
Anticipation is like this.
Anxiousness is like this.
Calmness is like this.
Doubt is like this.
Presence is like this.
Openness is like this.
Excitement is like this.
Curiosity is like this.
Appreciation is like this.
Focus is like this.
Forward thinking is like this.
Uncertainty is like this.
Uncertainty is like this.
Clarity is like this.
Not knowing is like this.
Weariness is like this.
Calmness is like this.
Gratitude is like this.
Nervousness is like this.
Anxiety is like this.
Again, just to give the listeners a taste, right? But maybe a good question to ask right now is how would you see practicing mind states plus is like this? How would that be applicable to what you do on the beach?
I think the is like this, like you said, maybe separates it and detaches it from like a permanent mind state. And like the pace we go at in that practice, and just the fact that the mind state shifts just kind of shows you that they aren't permanent, that they don't last. You can kind of be on one end of the spectrum and then like excited at one moment and then down on another. It just moves fast.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing, how quickly it can change. And like we were saying earlier, kind of once you notice it, once you name it, it seems to start to fade away. And then something else, maybe something that you guys say or a noise in the room or who knows what makes me feel something differently or notice something differently.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And I hope, you know, the listener can make the connection between the practice, right, of mind states here and then how that translates to what happens on the beach, on the court, on the field, whatever, where you can just use that phrase, the mind state is like this, and that way then again regain control over your attention and your actions.
Yeah, that's why I love the practices that you've done. I had done some previous, maybe it was more meditation than mindfulness, where I felt really relaxed. But I didn't feel a lot of like transfer to life. Where this, you know, we had done things like this with you previously. And I remember feeling I was going to do a performance and I was very nervous. And I just sat for 2 minutes by myself and just started to notice all that was coming up, all that I was feeling. And then I was able to decide, you know, how I wanted to be, how I wanted to respond. So it just feels like you can really transfer this stuff straight into life, straight into performance.
Yeah, and I know that we have as a team, and I think it's helpful for other teams listening that if you have this practice and this kind of dialogue, then all of a sudden in a timeout, you might be able to just kind of say a couple mind states and notice it, and then, you know, maybe switch gears.
Yeah, beautiful. So I think it's you know, it's really applicable to the world of sport. And personally, I'm really excited about this social noting practice and what it can lead to, you know, practicing with athletes.
Peter, I have just a curiosity out of the way you've trained yourself, and I've been able to be in a lot of sessions with you, and how you have it doesn't seem like you have an urge to fill the space with words. You're happy to let the space be open until someone wants to say something. I'm guessing that is by design. Is their reason? And I think just for coaches who feel like they really have to give feedback and say a lot all the time, why do you do that?
Well, I found that in that pregnant pause, so to speak, very often the wisdom will arise from the athlete rather than having to come from me. And I find that much more powerful than when I sort of barge in with my idea of what wisdom might be. So as uncomfortable as silence can be, it tends to bear beautiful fruit.
Have you found yourself, are you able to be more comfortable with silence now, or you just embrace that? I guess you just embrace it.
Yes, I've become more comfortable. So it's become a practice, so to speak, right? It wasn't initially, that level of comfort wasn't initially there, no, but gotten better over the years.
Yeah, and it seems like, especially once, I mean, you develop a relationship with your players, it won't be as uncomfortable to have those pauses. Because I know, I think when I first met with you, I noticed that too, John, where there's like, you kind of would like, it'd be quiet and I would be like, are we done? Should I leave? But usually it just led me to say something to fill it and kind of like maybe even dig deeper or say something that I would have just let pass or ignored.
Yeah, and I think the other advantage is that you, a lot of the times, allow the person to discover the answer. And I think coaches and anybody, parents, they want to give the answer. And I think if you give it, then it's not your answer. You don't retain that information as long. So yeah, I just see lots of benefits to the way that you, I don't know, do you call it teach or the way that you lead sessions?
Well, I think I guess the way I would phrase it, the way I try to be present in a session.
Right.
And I feel like for me, I'm not quick to ask questions. And so I could see a player like maybe have a question that they're on the fence about asking, and they would just like, you know, once the team moves on, they just kind of like forget about it. But if there is that moment of silence, maybe that would encourage them to ask it. So Peter,
yes, very much so.
Peter, outside of volleyball, how is mindfulness useful in our daily lives?
Well, I think, you know, particularly nowadays in these times, right, when there's so much uncertainty and there's, you know, this big gap between what we want and what reality actually serves up, invariably will be bombarded by very difficult thoughts and feelings. So where mindfulness comes in is not by making those thoughts and feelings go away, but by skillfully relating those thoughts and feelings. So it's super important actually right now in these challenging times that we're in, that we all skillfully work with our minds.
A bonus question. It came up in our discussions too, Peter. I feel like along with being bulletproof, it seemed like I thought going into sports, working with a sports psychologist is just to build confidence. Like, oh, if you see them, you'll be more confident for your play. But you had kind of a different take on what confidence was. Could you maybe share your thoughts on confidence?
Yeah, sure. Because I mean, sometimes I have to admit, I rub my colleagues the wrong way here with my position is I don't really care about confidence, to be quite honest, because confidence to me is a feeling state, right, that comes and that goes. And when athletes focus on, I want to be confident, I think they're actually barking up the wrong tree. And so I like to separate the feeling of confidence, which almost always comes after a specific action, from the action of confidence. And I can take the action irrespective of how I feel. So to give you an example, last year in the Stanley Cup playoffs, the Tampa Bay Lightning won the President's Trophy. They ran away with the league title, right? They were super confident that they're going to win the Stanley Cup. In the first round of the playoffs, they played the Columbus Blue Jackets, a team that had never won a playoff round at that point in time. But a team that was very gritty, very ready to compete, wasn't intimidated at all by the Lightning, won the first two games on the road, and the Tampa Bay Lightning never recovered. So their confidence did not help them at all. It gave them a false sense of security that they're going to win that first round, no problem. They didn't expect any challenges, right? Challenges came up, as they always do in sport, and they couldn't adjust because they were rigid. So when an athlete says, hey, can you help me be confident? My answer is no, I can't. Because again, I'm not helping you with something that's actually very effective, because feelings they come and they go. We don't control that much. What I'm after is, can I help you notice what feeling is present? And can I help you understand how that feeling impacts your actions? And then if those feelings don't help your actions, can you take charge of your actions and use your values to guide your behavior? So basically, in a nutshell here, Billy, is I'm a very mean sports psychologist. I tell my athletes, I don't care how you feel, and I don't care how and what you think. I do care that you notice what you feel, and I do care that you notice what you think, because then you can skillfully respond to that.
And I found that message actually comforting, because it wasn't like I had to master some mental hurdle and be confident before I could actually win games. You can still, you know, you can be nervous and struggle with confidence and still control your actions, you know, stand upright, fake it, come in hard, be a good teammate, and do all those things that it takes to win, even if you don't have that nice feeling.
Correct. Yes. All those actions are not contingent on you feeling a certain way.
Cool. Well, it's great talking to you. It's been great this whole year getting to work with you more. That's been probably the biggest positive of, I guess, this quarantine for me. And it was nice to have you on and share some of it with the listeners. So thanks for everything you've done for our team and then for USA Volleyball.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Pleasure to be on, and always a privilege to work with you guys.